House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's real close to 3:15 a.m. on February 27th.
A.m.?
Pardon me?
A.m.? Did you say a.m.?
I said real close to 3:15 p.m.
Okay.
I can check if you like. With us today, we have Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, Representative Culver, Representative Josephson, Representative Keto, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. We only have two items on the bill today, and I hope we get through both of them. I think we will. House Bill 32, Workers' Comp Control Substance Test, also known as UAs. House Bill 116, which is extending the sunset date of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, which at this point is still the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. With that, first bill up is House Bill 32. Conrad Jackson from my staff will be presenting the bill. It'll look real familiar to, let me just Andy, Representative Josephson. We had this bill last year. It moved out of committee and didn't quite get all the way through the process before the end of session. It's back with the last version of the bill that was out last year. No changes other than a new bill number. Welcome back, Conrad. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. Mr. Chairman, you are correct. This is a new bill from last year. Last year's bill was House Bill 370. But with that, I will just jump into House Bill 32, the bill before the committee today. The bill is intended to address one of the factors in the high cost, the high workers' compensation rates in Alaska, and that is opiates. First, by allowing drug testing for opiates under very specific circumstances, and second, to limit opiate prescriptions to a 30-day supply. As I said, the bill's focus is on the high cost of workers' compensation. The bill's twofold approach really addresses the epidemic of opiate use and abuse, and is trying to address the escalating cost of prescription drugs in workers' compensation treatment. To summarize the three sections of the bill, you can see it's a fairly short bill. The first section authorizes drug testing of injured workers if the employee has been prescribed a controlled substance for over 90 days. The negative test result may result in denial of future payments for that controlled substance by the employer. Test results, either negative or positive, may not result in any adverse employment action. That is very specific in the legislation. And as you can see, the may in that section is permissive. It does not mandate a test after 90 days. That is not the intent. Section 2 simply requires the Workers' Compensation Board to adopt regulations pertaining to the third section of the bill. The third section of the bill is the limitation on a physician's prescription of controlled substances listed under Schedule A, 1A, 3A, or 5A in Title 11 to a 30-day supply. The employer, in this case, in the tail end of Section 3, it specifies that the employer may not be liable for future payments, again, if the for Schedule A, 1A controlled substances if the employee receives a negative drug test. This legislation is designed to limit and really discourage the use of long-term opioids by restricting prescriptions to those 30 days. The statistics show that one in four prescriptions is used by someone who has not been prescribed the medication. This is medication that the employers are paying for, either directly or through insurer premiums. That's the point of trying to reduce those prescriptions and lower the cost of workers' compensation. The drugs referred to here are opioids. They're a synthetic version of opium-derived drugs. They are not. They are not mild drugs. They are not to be taken lightly. Scheduled drugs are defined in Title 11 of statute, and there's a lengthy list. Studies also show that higher usage and higher dosages of opioids over long periods of time can lead to addiction, increased disability or work loss, and potentially even death. Deaths from overdoses have grown dramatically, and they're in many states, they've exceeded those of automobile crashes. Prescription drug use is actually a abuse, actually, is an epidemic, been declared an epidemic by the CDC. Mr. Chairman, I have a number of other points and some other statistics here, and I'm happy to go through them, but I'll just leave it at that. And if the committee has questions, I'm happy to answer those. We also have a number of folks in the room. Mike Monagle from the Division of Workers' Compensation for any more detailed questions as far as workers' comp is concerned.
I might have we have Lori Wagner from the Director of Division of Insurance for questions. We also have Alicia Ellison from the AG's office for questions as well. But I've got the first question for you, Conrad. There would be nothing to prevent a patient for getting with a serious chronic problem to getting a new prescription as long as he visited a doctor for past 30 days.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely, that is correct. What we are trying to accomplish with this bill is to stop a 90-day prescription going out the door and limiting it to 30 days. At the end of those 30 days, or as a patient approaches that 30-day limit, certainly go back to the doctor, revisit that issue, and get another prescription if it's deemed necessary. The point of the bill, obviously reducing the cost, but the point is really to get workers healthy and back to work as quickly as possible. And proper pain management is a key component in that. If it takes opiates to do that, so be it. If it takes aspirin or some other pain reliever, so be it.
And just for clarification, if the drug test comes back negative, that means it's not in their system. And so part of it is also to make sure employers are not paying for drugs that aren't being used and instead might be sold by the person illegally. And then I wonder, that's part one. And then part two, you mentioned about the overdoses. I just was wondering if you knew with the overdoses, are those people that have been prescribed by a physician, or are those people that are overdoses usually people that are buying those drugs? I'm just illegally just curious on that one.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, on your first question regarding negative tests, the point of the negative test is, as you said, to stop a new prescription, a new cost to the insurer, to the employer, just because they've reached the end of the prescription. We want to, if the patient doesn't need the medication, we need to stop paying for the medication. Whether they're selling it, we're not accusing anyone of selling it if they have a negative test. They may be putting it on the shelf. I can imagine that, putting the bottle on their shelf in the medicine cabinet because maybe the drug, they have a strange interaction with it. Maybe they aren't having as close a personal contact or conversation with their doctor. We're not saying anyone is a criminal here. We are strictly trying to use a drug test as an opportunity to make sure that they are taking the medication. If they're not, as I said before, so be it. We will stop paying for, or the employer, the insurer, may stop paying for the prescription, visit the doctor and see what kind of pain medication they do need. If, in fact, they are consciously attempting to wean themselves off the pain medication, and some folks I've talked to have questioned that, there's nothing wrong with that, I don't believe. I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on TV. That's something that the patient and the doctor would need to work out. Personally, I would applaud that. But the goal is not to harm the injured worker by saying no more heavy drugs, no more opiates, if they're just trying to wean themselves off and it's just not working quite as well as they thought. We don't want to further injure an injured worker. as to your other question, the source of the overdose drugs, I believe that in some of the reports that are in your packet, it does specify some of the sources. Honestly, at the top of my head, I couldn't tell you that. But the prescription drugs, I think in many cases, the deaths are not... I better not speculate. I'll just leave it at that.
I think I'll interject at this point in time. I think the last numbers I heard were approximately one-third of the Alaskan population is subject to random UAs already, with much more stringent results if they test positive. Slope workers lose their job with a positive a result. People in the transportation industry, maritime industry, pilots, military, certain parts of the military are all already subject to this. So it's not like we're putting something out there that has not been in use for a long time.
Follow up.
And then yep. Representative Culper.
And I just want to say that it's a good bill and I support it. And I do think that it's something we've got to get workers' comp costs down. That's going to be good for Alaska. I'm just curious how it would work as far as for the employers, because the chair just informed us that it would, that one-third is already subject to random testing. So would it be such that a person, employee, might show up at work? Are there any rules or statutes around how an employer can administer a drug test? I mean, they have to give warning to the employee, or they just show up and it's like, you know, you're going to do this today? Or just wondering if the employee would have advance notice, how it would work.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, that's actually, I appreciate you asking that question. We are dealing specifically with Title 23, which is workers' compensation. You walking into your truck driving job, for instance, to pick a potential drug testing occupation. We're not talking about the day-to-day workers. We're talking strictly injured workers who have been, and here's one of the keys, on a prescription medication, the opiate, the scheduled drugs, for 90 or more than 90 days. Mm-hmm. And that's really the key. If you have a short-term prescription, you're not subject to this at all. It's that 90 days that begins that opens the option for the drug testing, again, of the injured worker, strictly Title 23.
So then how it would work, because I'm not that familiar with Title 23,
okay.
I'm sorry,
Representative Hughes, I apologize for not, through the chair, I apologize for not fully answering your question. I started to call him Representative. Mike Monagle from the Division of Workers' Compensation could probably better answer that, but that was something that would be laid out in statute, in regulation. Once we have some of the basic framework in place in the statutory change.
Thank you. Representative Culver, followed by Representative Keto.
Yeah, could you clarify who can order the test, the employer or the workers' comp carrier, and where that would be in this bill?
Representative Culver, through the chair, it's actually not as spelled out as you might think. It's actually, I expect to be, again, Mike could further clarify that, but in regulation, I expect that would be more clarified. If you read in section one of the bill, and let me adjust my arm length and eyes, it would be at the, excuse me for the proper term has just left the building, the claims manager. But as the employer, it applies, I think, across the board. And again, Mr. Monagle may be better able to clarify that as my brain escapes me today.
Thank you.
Representative Kino.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is the first time, I've seen the bill, the first time I've heard about the bill, so I might have a couple of questions to try and get me a little more comfortable with what's happening here. One of the concerns I do have is the state of Alaska establishing different classes of care for individuals, and I think if the state of Alaska believes that we need to make sure that there isn't abuse of narcotics, of scheduled drugs, then it would seem like we would want to actually make statutes apply to everybody that's receiving a prescription, not just those receiving workers' compensation support. So saying that, I think if there is also a concern about trying to keep people from illegally selling narcotics, it is already illegal to sell narcotics that aren't prescribed to you. So it should be, there should be other ways, I think, of investigating whether or not that's taking place. I don't think that a doctor who is removing the ability of a person to receive narcotics would be able to provide evidence to an investigation on whether an individual might be selling narcotics. So there's, in my brain, I guess, maybe a little bit of a disconnect. But if you could help me answer a couple of questions. One of the questions is, can you let me know, if you do, or maybe somebody else, how long typically does it take for these scheduled narcotics to clear the bloodstream? So once somebody has stopped taking, when would they have a clear UA? And then let me know the percentage of cases that this would apply to in Alaska. So if we've got, 100 workers' compensation cases, how many cases would be beyond 30-day narcotic usage or prescription? And then just a clarification, it seemed as though, and I think I got this correct, that this 30-day supply is just that the doctor would have to renew the prescription after a 30-day period for any individual that has a narcotic prescription. That's what I thought you had said. So if you had that information, that would help me out quite a bit. Thank you.
Representative Kito, through the chair. Before I get into your three questions, you mentioned the illegal, you felt that it is currently illegal, and you're absolutely correct to sell prescriptions that are not, or prescription medications not prescribed to you. It's just flat illegal to sell any of them. Whether you're selling prescriptions that you were given or anyone else, yeah, the doctors and the pharmacists are the ones selling the prescription drugs.
Correct.
But otherwise, then everything is illegal. As far as the length of time for narcotics, depending on the opiates to leave a person's system, I think I would be really stretching my medical knowledge to try to guess at that. I'll go so far as to guess that different individuals, different body masses, male, female, and length of time that they've been on a prescription would all have an effect on that time frame, but I can't give you an exact time. Mr. Monagle may have a little better idea since he has dealt with workers' comp and prescriptions of, I would say, patients with prescriptions to opioids, but I can't guarantee that. I'd be happy to try to track down a doctor, track down some more details on that, but
that would be helpful. I think part of the question for me, if I'm is just what are we testing for? So if somebody is after 90 days, if a substance clears in one day, I could see confusion and issues. But if it's a 7-day and you'll still see evidence of medication, then that's a different question.
Representative Kito, through the chair. Yeah, thank you. As to the percentage of cases in Alaska, I do have a little bit of information. In 2011, prescription drugs comprised almost 20% of the medical costs of workers' compensation claims. Over 90% of the time, workers who missed a week or more of work had prescriptions covered by workers' compensation. And among that 90%, this starts to get a little bit broad, 60 to 90% were receiving opioids or narcotics. There may be some more current numbers available. As I said, that is 2011. But
that's
kind of a follow-up, but a quick question. So you're saying 60% of 90% of the 20%?
Through the chair, Representative Kito, yes, that's what I said.
I thought I tracked.
Is that what you meant?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's what it says on the piece of paper here. So, yes, that was what I meant to say.
Thank you.
11% of the population, or 11% of the injured workers?
Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to your math.
No, I've got the old math, not the new math.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Through the chair, as to the 30-day question for renewal of the prescription, Representative Keto, that is in fact the case. The hope is to encourage a stronger communication, more robust communication between the doctor and the patient, which will allow for another prescription for 30 days of an opioid, but will, it's envisioned, create that conversation, encourage that conversation that may mean that they never get that second or third prescription. So they may never reach a full 90 days that they would be getting automatically now.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Tilton.
Thank you. First, comment, could you repeat the statistics again? about tardiness, workplace tardiness, or absence.
Oh, okay. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'll start with the easiest number here because this is...
and the source also...
2011, and I apologize, my notes do not include the source, but I can find that. 2011... 20% of the medical costs and workers' compensation claims in Alaska were comprised of prescription drugs.
Okay.
Workers that missed more a week or more of work in over 90% of the time, so 90% of the workers who missed that week or more, had prescriptions covered by workers' compensation. Mm-hmm. And among the 90%, 60-90% were receiving opioids or narcotics.
Follow up, new question?
Yes. I mean, my original question was going to be about costs and what anticipated savings there could be, and you've given us some sense of that, but one of the things these statistics tell me is that injured workers are prescribed lots of drugs. And I'm just trying to think about what best we can do with that information, and whether this bill is the right means of utilizing that information or reducing costs.
Yeah, I might take a shot at that one. This is one tool in the toolbox. Ultimately, within the next year or two, we're going to have hopefully completed development of best practices for pain management, more standardized practices for pain management. But typically, when you start somebody off with a drug that was developed to be an end-of-life drug for cancer patients without trying anything in between it, you can certainly make the pain go away, but it's not necessarily the... or at least to me, and I'm not a doctor, it's a fast way to make the pain go away, but not necessarily the best way, because what happens is after several months of being on opioids, the likelihood of going back to work lessens, and we could probably find you some percentages on that, but the longer you're on OxyContin, the less likely you're going to have to returning to the job you had when you were injured.
Actually, if I could... Conrad, do we know of any study that says that this sort of legislation in, for example, the lower 48 in some state, or whether, essentially, whether this kind of regulation or statute achieves this result, that is, premiums that were $300 per month for each injured worker were then... $200 a month. Do we have any data like that?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, there have been other states who have implemented various reform legislation. Florida, Washington, Texas, Colorado come to mind. And at least in the case of Texas and Washington, they've seen significant reductions in deaths from opioid abuse. Just from those reforms. A number of states, I don't have a count here, but I know at least those, there's a fairly large study in the state of Florida and a fairly lengthy bill that they implemented.
that restricted physicians dispensing implemented the pain management guidelines, as the chairman spoke to, and restricted those dosages and the lengths of opiates. And all of those have contributed to a reduction in deaths in abuse of opioids. Exact numbers, percentages, I don't have them at my fingertips. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I might add, I believe we've got a relatively current national study on that that we can, might take a day or two to find it, but we can have it out to you. It's not my intent to move the bill today because we need to get these questions out and answered satisfactorily to make those of us, or those of you that haven't heard this bill before. Basically, it's Representative Josephson and I are the only two people other than all the people in the back of the room that have gone through this bill in a previous lifetime. But we can get that for you. And I believe the national study is from the Workers' Compensation Research Institute. And I know that if we don't have a current one, I'm suspecting that Mike Monagle has one that may even be newer than mine on it. And we'll make it available. I think if we have it digitally, we'll make it available to not only the members of the committee, but we'll post it on the committee website for everybody else. And I think we have some documents that will probably make everybody see it through a different light.
Thank you.
But with that, Representative Tilton, followed by Representative Keto, followed by my vice chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The long term, or I don't even know what the term is, of the use of opioids leads to addictions. And then we have the addictions. I'm not sure if workers' comp covers costs of rehabilitation, or if there's a percentage of people if there's a number of percentage of people that end up needing to go into a rehabilitation that end up with an addiction because of that longer term usage of an opioid. This is the first question, then I have a second one.
Okay. Representative Tilton, mm-hmm. through the chair. I will start by saying that Mr. Monagle is probably better able to answer some of the numbers and things on the opioid addiction, past addictions and past patients, past injured workers. There's a study, I believe it's the Lockton study, that should be in your packet that does reference the addictions and the problems that are being seen around the country. And a little bit to Representative Josephson's point, if I can sneak that in your packets there's also some charts that show the deaths from overdoses in Alaska, if that's helpful to the members.
Thank you. Follow up. Next question is actually another question. Is there any information that can be provided, and maybe it's already in our packet, but just on opiates that are seized in investigations that could be connected to work comp type of situations where they are overprescribed and have that available? I'm not saying that people are criminals and would do that, but I'm just wondering if there's any stats on pain medication that's been compensated to show that they were part of a workman's comp claim.
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, I don't know that the Department of Public Safety tracks the source. They may have some obscure numbers somewhere. If they've actually found a bottle with a patient's name on them, that I would have to look into that and touch base with the Department of Public Safety. There is one page from a 2013 Department of Public Safety report in your binder that does talk about hydrocodone, oxycodone, and other prescription drugs seized, and then the dosage units over the course of 2011, 12, and 13. And that, I'm not sure if that will be enough information for you, but there is some place to start.
Thank you.
And we could certainly check with the Department of Public Safety and see if they are tracking it.
Mr. Chairman, that would be interesting. I'm sure it would be hard to track. But it might be interesting if there is any information on that.
If they have it, we'll get it. Representative Kido.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was trying to do the math a little bit, and I guess I was thinking, a little surprised that only 20% of workers' comp claims involved prescriptions, which I think is actually a good sign. But it seemed as though if I do the math down there, we're at about 1 or 1.2 people per 100 that might be the week or more over 90% that would be using an opioid. So I'm curious, one of the other things I think that you might say or you might have mentioned as a benefit is it would actually save money, or perhaps Chair had identified that. Do we have an anticipated cost savings to workers' compensation by implementation of this legislation?
Representative Keto, through the chair, I do not have those numbers. Those are numbers that are calculated by NCCI, the National... I'm sorry, I'm really having a
Council
National Compensation, Council Compensation Insurance. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The request has been made, but it does take them time to try to quantify what savings, what costs may be realized from the passage of the legislation. I can certainly poke and prod and see if I can speed that process up.
And on that same question, if we could get clarification if that data would be data applicable to Alaska or if it would be nationwide data, I'd be really curious if they could provide us with Alaska data. That would be particularly useful.
Representative Keto, through the chair, yes, it would be specific to Alaska with after, assuming that this legislation passed, they would put those numbers together. Okay. So we would see what Alaska rates, how they would be affected. Not as far as lower 48. That's I don't think this would have any effect on lower 48 rates at all. But unless I'm totally misunderstanding your question, I apologize.
Mr. Chair, just final follow-up. I think what I was trying to do is identify what, I mean, I think if we're looking at a cost savings for Alaska, we should know what ballpark we're looking for because we have an idea of how many claims have been submitted and how many would be opioids, and then maybe there's a statistic about how many would be abused. How much money does the state of Alaska or insurers stand to save on workers' compensation costs for this? I think if we're trying to save money, we should be able to identify how much money we're going to be able to save the program.
Representative Keto, through the chair, I absolutely agree. It is important to know what we're going to save. But another upside to the legislation is a number of people that we can hope to never have abusing the narcotics, either, God forbid, selling them, God forbid, dying, having children get into them, any of those other possible uses of an excess amount of the opioids out there. So there's a money savings component, but there's also just a life and a safety component as well.
Thank you.
And I might add that I would like to say this is an original bill, but it's already in place in a number of states. I think about half, might be a little more than half. And we'd get you the information on that. But again, this is going back here. I could be off a little bit one way or the other. And there have been significant savings. And we hopefully we can show what it's done in other states. Would that be helpful?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay, Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been an interesting discussion, and I appreciate it. And actually, this isn't so much about the bill again, because, well, I think it's important for us to have a foundation, especially for those of us who haven't been on this committee before. And I'm always concerned about protection of privacy for individuals. So we have an employee who is receiving medical care under a workers' comp claim. The employer somehow knows that they have been prescribed this. How does that work? Or is that information already that employers are being provided? Because how would they know that they would be allowed to perform the UA after the 90 days? I mean, is there information employers are receiving? I just want to understand how that works as far as one of their employees who's receiving care under workers' comp.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I would, I guess, defer that to Mr. Monagle, who is our workers' comp expert in the state of Alaska as the director of the division.
and follow up. Mr. Chair, I would like to know that what kind of information the employer is provided as far as their medical care.
We're going to be bringing them up shortly, and we also have the director of insurance in the room as well, who will probably have a slightly different perspective on it because they deal with different segments of workers' compensation. But not the only one that can't help us is Chris on this one, but we may call on her for math. Any further questions? Let's see, Representative Josephson.
Well, actually, Mr. Jackson said something that was, I think, helpful to me about, certainly there's a great argument that this is in the worker's interest as well, and that's something that I need to be aware of. One thing, however, is it goes to figure that the injured worker would be taking a painkiller. I mean, they're not generally taking a flu shot. That sort of figures. And I was still trying to get my hands around some of these questions. And actually, Representative Hughes has asked one that I'm intrigued by as well. So I look forward to hearing what Mr. Monagle can tell us about the nature of question about whether an employer is entitled to be privy to that sort of medical information. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Any further questions for Mr. Jackson? Mr. Monagle, will you join us, please? Welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank
you
for joining us Friday.
Yeah. For the record, my name is Mike Monagle. I am the director for the Division of Workers' Compensation for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And would answer any questions that you have. I'll just maybe start off with a note that when I look at this bill, I don't look at it in terms of cost savings to employers. I look at this more in terms of returning somebody back to work and preventing somebody from basically destroying their lives by long-term opiate use. I had an anecdotal case a number of years ago where a person about my age, early 50s, reached a point of medical recovery where he was physically fine. He had recovered from his injuries, but because he had been on opiates for several years, he had developed such cognitive and other problems that his doctor classed him as totally and permanently disabled. And it's those kinds of folks, I think, that this type of legislation is addressing. The 90 days is a number that's typically identified by medical studies as sort of the threshold on when those physical problems start to develop. And the curve of folks returning back to work starts to drop sharply after 90 days. And so the idea that you would have a 30-day supply of this type of drug necessitating another visit to your doctor and sort of a consultation and followed by another 30, and then that 90 day really is for the purpose of, if it's still being effective, then continue with that as long as there's an improvement in functionality. But in so many of these cases, there isn't an issue of functional improvement. People become addicted to these opiates and they continue the use. And nationwide, the emphasis is to wean off folks after 90 days, to get them to discontinue using the drug and to learn how to deal with their pain management in a more constructive way.
Thank you.
You said that so much better than I did. Follow-up or?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Monagle, relative to Representative Hughes's question and my own, I guess, about privacy in this area, and the employer's right to know how does that work?
Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Typically, when we talk in comp about employer, what we really are referring to is the employer, its insurance company, or its claims administrator.
most employers, unless you're self-insured, probably don't interact on a day-in, day-out basis with an injured worker. That's really coming from the insurance company or more likely their contracted claims administrator. So you have this claims administrator, a claims adjuster, who's in regular contact with that injured worker, is probably reviewing all the medical bills that come in, is authorizing payment of those medical bills, is issuing disability checks to that injured worker. And those are the folks that are going to have the information on these prescription drugs because they're seeing them, they're paying for them, and they know the frequency that these folks are using. And if there is a check on the prescription, it's probably being initiated by that claims administrator, not the employer directly.
I'll follow up on that.
So in the event you had a smaller workplace where there was more intimacy, then the employer queried the claims adjuster and said, how's my guy doing? Is the claims adjuster talk to you some discretion, or do they say, well, I got the file here, we think he's malingering, or... we see more evidence of opiate than we commonly see with that dosage. I'm interested in some of those dynamics.
Sure. And through the chair, workers' comp is excluded from HIPAA law. So the health care concerns that you might typically have between a provider and their patient do not apply in a workers' comp environment. Second, the provision of the Workers' Comp Act says that if you're a party to a case, you're entitled to any of the information about that case. And a party typically is the employer and the injured worker and their representative. So it could be the insurance company, the claims administrator, or if there's a legal counsel involved, the attorneys that represent those parties. And any of those parties would have access to the information under the Workers' Comp Act.
Sure. Do we have any, through the chair, do we have any statutes now that call for testing in situations other than operating heavy equipment, commercial carriers, that sort of thing?
Through the chair, and I think Attorney General Aisha Pallison is online, but I will take a crack at this, and she can correct me if I get it wrong. Under Title 23, Chapter 10, Section 600 through 699, there's a whole section in there about employer testing. First of all, it's a voluntary system. It's not mandatory that any employer test, but there is a voluntary system in place. It's not administered or regulated by the state. It's left open to private action. So if I feel as a worker that my rights have been somehow violated, my recourse is civil. But it goes on to say for the employer to put in a policy for testing, there are certain requirements that the employer undertakes. For example, it talks about giving the employees a 30-day notice before implementing the plan and letting them know the conditions of the testing, which substances will be tested for. The statute actually steps through all that information in quite a considerable amount of detail, and it does have remedies for somebody whose confidentiality is violated or somebody who has a false positive test, and that happened through negligence on the part of the employer or the person who's doing the testing for the employer.
Thank you.
I think at this point in time, Ms. Pallison, are you with us?
I am, yes.
Thank you, and please say your name and affiliation for the record. And did you hear Mike Monagle's questions?
I did. This is Aisha Pallison, Assistant Attorney General up in Anchorage. I did hear the question and Mr. Monagle's response. I agree with that. There are provisions generally for employer drug testing set out, as Mr. Monagle mentioned, at AS 2310. And this bill in Section 1 adds a section to that already existing drug testing regime for this particular situation of a negative drug test in workers' comp cases.
Any further questions for Representative Kito?
Mr. Chairman, I think actually a question back to Mr. Monagle. You had mentioned in an anecdote that somebody who had been on opiates for a prescribed long period of time. This legislation actually wouldn't do anything about that. It would only actually allow an action if somebody had not been taking opiates. So I'm just offering up that I don't know that that would actually solve this individual's tragic problem. But I do have a question about confidentiality. So if an individual who may have arthritis is injured in the workplace, they are taking some kind of medication prescribed there by their doctor for that, then for a specific injury, that doctor knows of the arthritis medication, and then they prescribe something on top of that because this particular injury has another, and that keeps them out of work because maybe they're over-medicated, appropriately medicated by their physician, and I guess actually I answered my own question because this legislation wouldn't apply in that case either. I was just thinking in terms of an individual who might have a protected confidentiality who then is tested by an employer and is not violating their other prescription, but their workers' comp prescription perhaps causes a problem. So I guess that's not really a question, but I do have a concern, I guess, about what we're actually trying to accomplish if we're really the only denial in this legislation is in regard to somebody who has not been taking prescribed medication. So I guess I'll put that as a comment.
Well, part of it is getting the injured employee to see his doctor to get a new prescription physically with OxyContin. You have to visit the doctor. You can't call up the pharmacy and have the pharmacy call up the doctor, unless somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe physically they have to have contact with their healthcare provider, and that would give the doctor a fresh impression on how things were going or weren't going if they have to do it every 30 days. And obviously that has a cost that might be incurred with it, but ultimately I think the savings would more than offset the of the cost. And again, the goal is to get the people back to work rather than lose them after 120 days or 90 days, whatever. But any further questions? Then I'm gonna go to Scott Jordan. Scott, are you with us?
I'm here in the room.
Thank you. Oh, okay. Good to see you, Brian. Chris, come on up. Can we take some questions?
I will.
I knew somebody was hiding back there.
For the record, I'm Scott Jordan, Director of Risk Management, and I'll be glad to ask for any questions you guys might have.
How about touching on the privacy issues?
Specifically, Mike addressed it, and that's our understanding too. The HIPAA does not, workers' comp does not it doesn't apply. HIPAA doesn't apply under workers' comp. So we do share records. We're self-insured, and we do share records. We do see our. I get a quarterly report of everybody who is on opiate drugs, so we know quarterly who is taking them.
Okay. Can you give us a rough idea on a percentage basis how many of your injured employees are taking the scheduled drugs?
I can tell you exactly. The last quarter report we had 67 people, and we have about 900 open claims, so less than 10%, less than 1% actually. So it's a low amount.
Representative Jones?
I just want to make sure I understand the denominator. You're talking about injured Alaska public employees?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, I'm talking state employees, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Jordan? Thanks again.
You're welcome.
Larry Wanghire.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming again, Director, and please state your name and affiliation for the record, and then tell us what we need to know.
My name is Lori Wenghire. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Thank you for having me. I think we've heard a lot of talk today about what the bill is intended to do or what we're looking to find the bill to do. And from the division's perspective, after all is said and done with the cost of the workers' compensation claims, the data comes to the division and we end up setting the rates. And the rates go to the employers of this state, including the state of Alaska. Mm-hmm. And as they've gone up, or as they've stabilized in the last year, they're still very high. We were quite proud this year that we fell off the number one spot in the nation. But we're still, it's still a very high cost to employers across the state. And any impact we can have in bringing down the cost of workers' compensation, we look very seriously at. And this is one. There's also then the impact to people themselves and the fact that narcotics have gone up, the use of narcotics, and people that get on them for a small period of time. Sometimes it does end up being a longer period of time. And as a former risk manager and an insurance broker, I can tell you that the cost of rehab is an expensive part of most of a workers' compensation claim when it does involve pulling somebody back off of being on an opioid for a long period of time. And again, that brings the cost of the claim up. It goes back into the workers' compensation rate, and all the employers pay. Mm-hmm. And so,
Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Kito.
Well, from my work in family law, where there was a custody dispute and allegations, more than allegations of prescription abuse, that sort of thing, there would normally be some sort of tracking of that by the prescriber. Wouldn't that information, if I'm right about that, to make sure that a drug contract, they would call them, was followed, wouldn't that information make its way back to the adjuster in any case?
Through the chair, the adjuster will have a record of the prescriptions that are being prescribed mm-hmm. to the injured employee. There is no doubt about that. But this bill is just trying to say that every 30 days that they must touch base with the physician again. It's not trying to take the narcotic or the painkiller away, but just to say that you need it every 30 days to keep it from being over-prescribed.
Yeah, if I may. Oh. That's all true. However, it's the first sections that the bill might very well move. It wouldn't be up to me. Swiftly, if it weren't for, and this bill is much improved, the first section of it, where there's the testing. And I'm just wondering whether there's some redundancy if the prescriber is already doing some of that. Because I think they are. That was certainly evidence I saw when I was in trial and documenting drug contracts. And I just was wondering, it occurred to me that maybe there is some redundancy there. Could an insurance adjuster today, February 27th, know those sorts of facts from the prescriber, from looking at the prescriber's file?
Through the chair, I think that the adjuster might, they will have know what the prescriptions are. Mm-hmm. Will they know if it's been overused or if they have not used that 30-day prescription and are getting another 30 days? Then stockpiling them, I don't know that they would know that, Representative Josephson.
Okay. If I may.
Sure.
The 67 out of 900 that the previous speaker discussed, there must be a way, I know that to cover state employees, it's about $1,400 a month for just about all of us. Is there some means of reporting to us what the cost for those 67 injured public employees is? I mean, we heard that 20% of the total cost is prescription drugs. I'm just wondering how much money we're talking about, and if there was some way, because you have sort of this controlled data and it's not spread out across the state in the private sector of discerning that, figuring out what it is.
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, I have the state data. I don't have the state of Alaska data per se. I have the cumulative data of all employers. You would have to ask Director Jordan what he has, because I don't have the individual data on state employees per se. I could tell you what all employees added together, all employers in the state are, but I couldn't tell you the state of Alaska.
All right, except that I thought we just heard what it was. It was 67 out of 900.
But the cost I couldn't tell you, sir.
Representative Kito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think back on the 67, I'm trying to get my head around. If we've got 67 total scheduled drug use cases, I can't imagine all of those are going to be over 90-day cases. So there's going to be a smaller number of those that will be the over 90-day. I can't imagine that all of those are going to be looking for violation cases. So it seems as though out of 67, we're probably looking at a very small number of individual cases that might be subject to this law. Do you have an idea of what that number, at least maybe statistically, might be?
Through the chair, Representative Kito, again, on the state plan, I don't have the inside knowledge of the state's plan, but I would agree with you that not every case within that 67 is over 30, but I couldn't confirm that, again, because I don't know what Director Jordan brought to the table when he was talking of his 67 of 90, or of 900, if those were over 90 or if that was just total what is on the state's claim record right now. You would have to ask him, sir. I don't know. I could get you probably some state statistical data as to where it breaks out, but that would be all employers.
Follow-up. So would this legislation apply to all employers?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, it would.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would be interested in seeing that data for all employers if you could get that.
Certainly. We will get that through the chair.
Any further questions? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Director Jordan. Thanks for coming back.
You're welcome.
Representative Josephson. Oh, please say your name and affiliation.
Yeah, for the record, Scott Jordan, Division of Risk Management Director.
Thanks.
So, thank you. Mr. Jordan, through the chair, we do not pay for our 20,000 some odd public employees. We don't write workers' compensation checks every month to an insurer. We've self-insured, is that right?
That is correct, through the chair.
Is there any way, if I could follow up on that, is there any way to ask Aetna, if this law passed, can you reduce our premiums to $1,300 a month from $1,400 a month? Is there some way to have something quantifiable like that?
Through the chair, I'm not sure I can answer your question because I don't know where the $1,400 premium you're talking about comes from. We don't have a premium. I mean, we're self-insured, so there is no premium for us.
I believe he's referring to the monthly major medical
health insurance
cost for state employees,
and
which would not have an impact because it's not related to workers' comp.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. At this point in time, I think I'm going to open it up to public testimony, and again, we're not going to be moving the bill today, obviously. Is there anybody in the other room that would care to testify? Has anybody signed up? I think I've got them all. Is there anybody online? With that, I believe I'm going to hold public testimony open, as tempting as it is to do otherwise, but I believe I'm going to hold the public testimony over. And with that, I think we're going to bring up this bill as soon as we get additional information. And I think a lot of good questions were asked, and I want to make sure we do it right and everybody's satisfied before they're asked to vote on it one way or another. And with that, I'm going to bring Conrad Jackson. Next item on the calendar is House Bill 116. It's extending the sunset on the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. Laura Sidoff from my office will present the bill.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank everybody that came for the first bill. And welcome back. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Steidoff, staff to Representative Olson. Before you today is HB 116. This legislation extends the termination date for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board to June 30th, 2018. Each year, the Division of Legislative Audit reviews state boards and commissions to determine if they should be reestablished per AS 2444. The Division of Legislative Audit reviewed the activities of the ABC Board. The purpose of this audit was to determine whether there is a demonstrated public need for the board's continued existence and whether it has been operating in an effective manner. The board has resolved all issues found in prior audits, with two being resolved and one being partially resolved. As the members may have noted from the audit, there were five findings and recommendations in the most recent audit, including having the board's director ensure that all board meetings are properly published on the state's online public notice system, notifying local governing bodies of applications for new and transfer licenses within 10 days of receipt, issuing catering permits and recreational site licenses in accordance with statutory requirements, and finally, that the board should implement a process to monitor and track all complaints to ensure they are resolved in a timely manner. It is the opinion of the Division of Legislative Audit that the board be extended 3 years to June 30th, 2018. We saw that in the opinion of our auditors, the board is serving the public's interest by effectively licensing and regulating the manufacture, barter, possession, and sale of alcoholic beverages in Alaska. To speak to the recommendations I mentioned earlier, Chris Curtis of Legislative Audit is here. Also, Cynthia Franklin, the director of ABC, is online from Anchorage. In closing, the ABC Board serves an important role in guarding the health and safety of Alaskans by protecting the general public through issuance, renewal, revocation, and suspension of alcoholic beverage licenses. The continuation of this board is very important. Thank you for your support of this legislation.
Representative Josephson, got a question?
Well, I think I'll save it for Ms. Franklin. Thank you.
You got off mic? Thank you very much. Chris, come on up. Chris Curtis is our auditor, the legislative auditor for, I think everybody's at least met her. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and welcome back.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Chris Curtis, legislative auditor. As Laura mentioned, we did conduct a sunset review of the ABC board, and we did conclude that it was serving the public's interest, but we did note that several operational improvements were needed in the licensing and general administration of the program, or of the board. The board is set to sunset June of this year. The audit recommended a five-year extension conditionally. At the point the audit was completed in May of 2014, we did not know the outcome of the marijuana voter initiative. So the audit recommended that the extension be only 3 years in the event that the marijuana voter initiative passed, as the initiative significantly expanded the board's duties. Going through the five recommendations fairly quickly, they begin on page 9 of the audit. First recommendation is for the board to ensure that meetings are publicly noticed. There were 25 meetings held during our audit period, and we found that 3 of them were not publicly noticed. Page 10, we recommend the board notify local governing boards of the applications for new and transfer licenses within 10 days of receipt, as required by statutes. We tested 10 licenses and found that 2 of them, the board did not inform the local governing bodies within the required time frame. These errors were caused by board staff not adhering to their policies and procedures. The recommendation was for the board to issue catering permits in accordance with statutory requirements. We reviewed 4 licensees that we saw had received more than 6 consecutive catering permits during the audit period, and we found that 3 of the 4 were non-compliant. Each of the 3 variances represent a statutory violation because the permits were issued with the intention to serve alcohol on a licensed premises and to maintain daily operations of the business rather than for a short-term social gathering or similar event. The board issued the permits to ensure the businesses could continue to operate. We also recommend on page 11 that the board issue recreational site licenses in accordance with statutory requirements. Of the 32 recreational site licenses that were active during the audit period, we found that 15 or 40% of the businesses did not meet the criteria for a recreational license. The ineligible businesses included bowling alleys, a sports center and pub, an exercise gym, gift shop, theaters, and pool halls. These business types did not meet the definition of a recreational site, nor were the operations limited to a season. The issuance of these licenses expanded the number of establishments licensed to sell alcohol over the number allowed for in statute. Inquiries with board members revealed that the improper issuance of these recreational site licenses was caused by an historic misunderstanding of what qualifies as a recreational event. And then finally, on page 12 is our last recommendation, and this is for the board to implement a process to monitor and track all complaints and to ensure that they are resolved in a timely manner. The board did have a process to receive complaints. However, complaints were only tracked if they resulted in an inspection or investigation. If the complaint was deemed invalid, it was not documented. Furthermore, the basis for a decision not to investigate was not documented and maintained. The board director did not consider tracking all complaints as necessary because there was no statutory mandate to do so. Both the department and the board agreed with all recommendations and submitted corrective action plans.
Representative Joseph.
Oh, thank you. I'll take it.
you were signaling.
Sorry, I was in my eyes. Ms. Curtis, through the chair, you said that relative to recommendation number four that there was a misunderstanding. That's how you characterized that. Mm-hmm. Did the board, is everyone on the same page now about proper reading of the whatever statute this is?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, we believe so through the management letter and report process. In the department or the board's response to the audit, which is in the back of the report, mm-hmm. They reported they were operating under guidance from the Assistant Attorney General's office mm-hmm. when making these decisions, and that they have since rethought that process and took some public testimony regarding that and went back to the more stricter interpretation of statute.
Yes, the Title 14, for lack of a better word, that I hear about, there's a stakeholders group that's looking at rewriting large parts of that. Should that, I assume that's going to be done soon, and I really want to ask Ms. Franklin about this as well. Should that give us some pause or some reason to only extend this for 2 years in combination with the marijuana board? The marijuana board, which will fall, have a shared staff, is what's being considered.
Representative Justin, through the chair, the recommendation for extension took into consideration the results of the audit. So the findings and recommendations went into the 3-year versus 5-year extension. At the point the audit was completed, we had no idea about what was going to happen, if the initiative was going to pass, or what they would do regarding a marijuana board. In scanning the proposed legislation for the marijuana board, they are sharing staff. They are proposing to share staff with the Board of Alcohol, the ABC board. I did not see a sunset provision in the proposed legislation for the marijuana board. So that creates confusion on my part on auditing the ABC board when they're sharing staff with the marijuana board, and if possibly if the extension was added, termination date a day was added to the marijuana board, whether they might get out of sync at some point, whether we would be auditing one and then the next year auditing another, maybe inefficient use of audit resources. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
I think I can make a comment on that. I think that as the marijuana bill moves forward, it will have a sunset that will look amazingly like the same date as the ABC, just to keep them on track, both entities. But I'd like to add that in the Department of Commerce, we have a number of employees that are shared jointly by different boards and commissions. It's fairly common. I think it's probably over half of them or more than that.
Through the chair, the occupational boards, is that what you're referring to? As share staff, yes.
So it's not a major major factor. It's just more for efficiency, I believe. Mm-hmm. But Got a question for Chris?
I do, and it's a little bit of a follow-up because I think the question was more about the Title IV revisions, which would change some of the duties, and you may not be familiar, and that's just a proposal. And I'll just make the comment, I think the 3 years would still work for that, but just wondering if you are familiar with that and you have any comments as far as what's being proposed if it were to go through in the three-year period.
Vice Chair Hughes, through the chair, at the time we did the field work, which was late spring, we were aware of the stakeholders group, and we knew that there was activity looking at statutes and regs, but we didn't know anything about the outcome or where it was going at that point.
Okay, thank you.
And we're going to be bringing up Ms. Franklin next. Representative Kito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. First one on recommendation two. There were, it looked like you had, was it two that did not get the appropriate notice. Is there any cause for the state to find out whether or not those decisions were made without adequate local involvement if there was not adequate notice? First question.
Through the chair, we did not see the impact, we did not see any complaints by the local governing body or any outcome resulting from the lack of timely. There are some time frames built in to allow for adequate response, and the delay was between 11 and 20 days. I believe they have 90 days to respond, so I don't believe it really bumped up against the 90-day time frame.
Okay, thank you. And then on recommendations three and four, it looked like there were a couple of different violations identified. Do we know that those violations have been corrected? Have the permits been removed where inappropriate?
Through the chair, the audit team does not know that, and that would be a good question for the department.
Thanks again. Ms. Franklin, are you with us?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for spending your Friday with us. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and we'll start throwing questions out.
My name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, and I'm testifying today from Anchorage.
Representative Kito.
Thank you, Ms. Franklin. I think in follow-up to my questions on recommendations three and four, can you let me know that those changes have been implemented and improper permits have been withdrawn?
Through the chair, yes and no. The catering permits, issue number three, those are for individual events that had already passed at the time that the audit determined that they had been improperly issued. So the catering permits are issued for specific events that occur and then they are over. They're a very short-term permission to sell or serve alcohol. And what was happening with those catering permits, this was prior to my coming on board with the agency last September, but there had been a practice when a liquor licensee was transferring their license and they were waiting on approval. So in other words, they had an expectation that they were going to receive a license, a permanent license, but while they were waiting, there were catering permits being issued that allowed them to continue or an operation of selling or serving alcohol while they waited for whatever transfer procedure, particularly with stock transfers where the ownership of the organization was changing, but the day-to-day operations were not. The agency was issuing catering permits to allow a sort of a non-interruption of service, if you will, in that license activity, and that was determined to violate the catering permit statute. So that practice had already been discontinued when I came on board. We do have safeguards in place to check all catering permits to make sure that type of activity is not happening. And that involves some coordination between the licensing and enforcement sections that I think was not occurring prior to my coming on board. So I can assure you that isn't happening anymore and is not going to be happening. With regard to the rec site licenses, it's a little more complicated because there were liquor licenses issued to businesses that
did not technically qualify under the statute for a recreational site license. The best example that I could give you is a rec site license that was issued to the Alaska Club South location. When you look through the statute on rec site licenses, that is a gym that operates every day. It's not an event. It's not a basketball game. People go there every day. They have a liquor license. And so the board is not going to be able to review that license until they come up for renewal. However, the board is hyper aware that it overstepped its bound in issuing that and a couple of other recreational site licenses. And so I expect the issue to be addressed by the board when those licenses come up for renewal.
Bob? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Franklin, thank you. I think I ended up with two questions out of the two questions, so I apologize.
Sure.
But do we have provisions in statute that allow for transition of facilities? So I can see there are issues where you're transferring ownership and there's a gap. Is there another method for you to be able to issue a transitional license?
Through the chair, not really. And this just came up this week with a large stock transfer that's taking place in a large business. And there are some chicken and egg problems when it comes to stock transfers, depending on, obviously depending on the individual transfer that's taking place and whether it's going from one business to another. An example that I can give you where the catering permit issue came up again, and we had a licensee who was aware of our former practice and not aware that we had come into compliance after the audit, is a license that was sold, a beverage dispensary license that was sold here in Anchorage. And so Sourdough Mining Company sold their BDL to Texas Roadhouse, and with the intention that they would come in and get a restaurant eating place license that would allow Sourdough to continue selling beer and wine with their meals. Mm-hmm. And they just they really have to engage in careful planning. So had he come in and applied for the restaurant eating place license ahead of time, there would have been nothing that would have prevented him from being in the process of getting those approvals and having everything in place for a smooth transition when he sold his beverage dispensary license. Because of the way the business transaction took place, he sold his beverage dispensary license and then started working on getting his restaurant eating place license, and it did lead to an interruption in service of alcohol at Sourdough. But in that case, the person seeking those transfers was really somewhat in control of the order of proceedings and could have planned better. So we really have to be careful. We are trying to be accommodating to our licensees and work with our licensees. And however, this is a place where statute clearly did not authorize us to issue catering permits to Sourdough so that he could continue to sell and serve alcohol as his customers expected while he got that other license in place. So we are happy to provide that information and help people through the process, but in some cases it's out of our control if they wait too long, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
They have to be smart about it.
Yes, it does. Thank you. And actually, I was just wondering if there might be a fix we needed, but it sounds like procedural, and there are ways to work with this existing system. My second follow-up question really was on the next one, on recommendation four. I guess I do have a concern that we have facilities operating out there, possibly illegally, if they have received a permit in error, and I'm concerned that we have operations happening where they should maybe have gotten or gone for a regular alcoholic beverage license and instead got a recreational license. They might not have been granted an alcoholic beverage license or a regular license, but now they have a recreational license that's been issued in error. So I do have a concern, I guess, that we have facilities operating in violation of our current law. And so maybe I'm missing something, but is that the case or is that not the case?
Through the chair, I wouldn't say that they're operating in violation of the law because they legally obtained the license through the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. We did agree with the audit findings that the definition of recreational site license had been stretched beyond its original intent. And as was mentioned earlier in the hearing, those decisions apparently were made upon advice of counsel. So I don't think that anyone could argue that those licensed establishments are violating, are operating in violation of the law, because they obtained their licenses lawfully from the board with, you know, the local governing body approvals and all of the other approvals that have to take place before those licenses are obtained. The fact that after the licenses were issued, you know, we had an opinion from the auditing agency that those licenses stretched the boundaries of the statutory definition of what would have been allowed under that statute, I don't think makes their licenses them being operating unlawfully, excuse me. However, I understand your concern, and that's why I believe that the board will be taking those up individually as they come up for renewal, according to their understanding. The other thing to point out, I guess, would be is that this agency changed departments during the period that the audit was being performed, and so even the council has changed. We don't have the same assistant attorney general that we had when these decisions were made, and so really everything has changed for this board, and they have a fresh outlook on this statute. So I have faith that these licenses will, you know, ultimately be strictly reviewed in the renewal process, which occurs every other year.
Thank you.
Representative Culver.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Franklin, could you turn to your fiscal note, please? Your budget, do you have that handy?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so FY16, $3.35 million, and then we go to fund source, identifies $1.575 million GF and approximately $1.8 million in program receipts. Can you kind of break that down for us? I'm just kind of interested in the program receipts coming in from the industry and how much we go to the general treasury for. Obviously, there are a number of alcohol taxes that go into GF as well, and maybe if you had that number handy, what kind of revenue is that generating? You've got us trained when we talk about boards and commissions that they're zero offset to the treasury, so I guess that's my line of questioning. Thank you.
Right. Through the chair, I don't have the tax receipts at hand, so I apologize for that. What I can say about the receipts that we take into the agency for fees for alcohol licenses, those are the receipts that are reflected there in the fiscal note. And we have the fiscal note includes money for the agency as funded, as expanded. And it was mentioned earlier that, you know, beginning in November with the passage of ballot measure 2, the agency's scope has expanded to include this second substance, and that is reflected in the fiscal note. What's not reflected in the fiscal note is receipts from those licenses. So we don't know yet how many marijuana licenses will be issued and what the receipts for the fees from those licenses will be. So that is what accounts for more money being reflected from the general fund in this budget, is that at least that first year of marijuana licensing, we, you know, again, a chicken and egg problem. We can't get the licenses out and begin receiving receipts for applications and fees and taxes on those licenses until we have the staff to get those licenses out. So what you're seeing there is a first year problem for the agency in terms of expanding enough to be able to safely regulate both substances and awaiting the receipts from both the fees and taxes on the new substance.
Paula?
Yeah, thank you. because I don't have last year's information in a column, I can't compare year to year looking at what your entire operations were under the current fiscal year versus what you've indicated that about $1.575 million is being charged off to new regulations regulating the marijuana industry. But maybe you can get back to us with those stats, how much of this budget is for regulating that industry that you're going to be regulating, and what was the agency budget last year? If you don't have that data.
The agency budget last year was $1.75 million.
Okay.
And the FY16 budget for the new substance includes a large one-time appropriation for a database, because currently our agency is a paper-based agency. So we know, because we've learned and because we've already experienced it, that there are going to be a lot of questions about marijuana and a lot of demand for data. And the $500,000 request for a database was already in the budget before I came on board with the agency, in the sort of draft budget that was created at the time when questions were being asked about how much it would cost to regulate that substance if ballot measure 2 passed. So the FY16 budget for marijuana doesn't match our underlying alcohol budget, because it's not doubling the agency. It's adding six additional employees through an FY15 supplemental and the FY16 budget request. So it expands our agency from a staff of 10 to a staff of 16 statewide to regulate both substances. But it appears to mirror our budget because it has that large one-time expense to the database.
Okay, I'll just wrap it up. Mr. Chairman, when we look at FY17, 18, 19, it's the same increment. So it doesn't reflect what you said is one-time IT database upgrade. Maybe you might want to look at tweaking the fiscal note on out years, because it shouldn't include that one-time database issue or expense. Anyway, I think I'm done with the issue. I appreciate it. Thanks for the clarification, and we look forward to working with you on the other project as well, on the other half of this budget.
Yeah, the big half. Representative
Hughes.
You're right. I almost called on Kathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being online with us. And just a question you may have heard earlier, just wondering your comments on the three-year extension, considering the marijuana issue. And then also just the proposed Title IV revisions. I know you're aware of those, and how that might impact. Just your comment as far as the appropriateness of the three-year period, if you think that's a good plan.
Through the chair, yes, I think it's a good plan. The Title IV revisions are actually with Senator Machicki. They're going to be introduced through his sponsorship. And so the group has finished its work. Regarding earlier questions, there was no work that the group did that went beyond the auditor's findings that regarding these specific issues reflected in the audit, particularly the permit issues, that the board really just needs to stick to the strict statutory interpretation. And there was no work done in the group to tweak any of those permits or licenses, aside from the stakeholders group expressing its intention that the board strictly follow the statute in those two types of permits. Regarding the three-year period, because the revisions to Title IV are so extensive in that legislation that the stakeholders group is recommending, and because this two-board, one-agency setup that is reflected in Senate Bill 60 is new to us. I do think that a three-year timeline is appropriate.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Yes.
Representative Joseph?
I know it's late in the day, but since I've got her here and I've never met her. Ms. Franklin, can you, in discussions I've had about the stakeholders group, there have been sometimes concern expressed about the membership. Do you believe it was a balanced stakeholders group, and can you give us an idea, not of names, but groups represented and in numbers?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, I can't. It was a balanced group. We had multiple representatives from the public health sector. Many of the chair people of our individual subcommittees were public health representatives. Diane Casso from DHSS chaired our underage drinking subcommittee. Jeff Jesse from the Mental Health Trust chaired the licensing subcommittee. We had Bob Klein, who's the chair of the ABC board, on the steering committee. We had a representative of the Rasmussen Foundation on the steering committee. We had representatives from every sector of the liquor industry on several of the subcommittees. So we had manufacturers represented. We had breweries represented. We had retail package store representation. We had bar and restaurant eating place representation. We had local government representation in the forms of many municipal employees that were part of the subcommittees. And we have a report that we will happily share. I could send it to Representative Olson's aide and for sharing with the committee that has a complete listing of all of the stakeholders on the group and a PowerPoint presentation that has a slide with the makeup of each subcommittee. So if you're interested in seeing more detail on that, but there was a lot of representation. It was a lot of work. And so we did see that the work began in May of 2012, and there were some members early on that dropped off. There were some individuals who joined the group later. There was somewhat of a variation at any given point in time of who was at the table, but it was a fairly incredible process.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kim. I'll open it up to anybody in the room care to testify? Seeing none, is there anybody online that I can't see? Seeing none, it's my intention to move the bill out today, or the bill, because the heavy lifting is going to be done in the finance department, and the sooner we get it over to them, the longer they'll have to the work on it. So are there any committee comments?
Well, I mean, we're going to have an ABC board.
Oh, yeah. That's a subject extension. Yeah.
So I'm told that Ms. Franklin is doing a great job, and I think we should move this bill out.
I'll entertain a motion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move HB 116-29-L70596 /A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no opposition, the bill / A moves out of committee, and with that we will adjourn, and thanks again everybody in the room and everybody on the committee. It's been a long day.